Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about why I chose that particular reading. It's unusual to use a song as a reading. I chose it because I believe it helps us get in touch with our Unitarian Universalist roots. Vincent B. Silliman, the writer, he was a Unitarian minister and then a Unitarian Universalist minister after the merger in 1961. I'm guessing that for saying the words, our loyalty commanding was a challenge. It is easy to look back in time at previous writings from Unitarians and Universalists and think to ourselves, how quaint. And I could never say that. I think this is a song that doesn't get a lot of airplay, probably for that specific reason. Who wants to be the music director who has their congregation sing about loyalty? It's not something that Unitarian Universalists are known for. However, it's a good reminder that our history is full of people who are very, very much committed to their Unitarian faith, sometimes even to their own detriment. The example of this I'm going to talk about today is the Unitarian minister Ethelred Brown. He had an overwhelming loyalty to Unitarianism at a time when it was quite clear that the American Unitarian Association, the precursor to the Unitarian Universalist Association, did not have the same loyalty to him. I learned of Brown through a class I took this past spring on UU history and UU philosophical readings. Among other books we read for the class, the book Black Pioneers and a White Denomination by Mark Morrison Reed was a serious wake-up call about how Unitarianism has racism as part of its institutional history from the beginnings of our movement. It was a difficult book to read because it plainly and clearly describes the ways in which Unitarians took a long time to take a stand against slavery, and many Unitarian churches refused to even open their doors to black people. This was a hard enough to read, but then Morrison spends the first half of the book describing the life of Ethelred Brown and how he was treated by the American Unitarian Association from the early 1900s through the 1940s. Morrison Reed also wrote about Lewis McGee, an African-American Unitarian minister who served from the 40s through the 50s. For the purpose of this sermon, I will be focusing on Ethelred Brown because I find his life and the treatment he received by the AUA so fascinating. But before I go on, I have to acknowledge my own trepidation in telling this story. The sermon began as a class project I submitted a couple of months ago, and as the time for this sermon drew near, I began to become more hesitant. As I mentioned in the bio earlier, that I'm doing a unit of clinical pastoral education this summer, which is all about noticing and identifying feelings. If you should ever do anything like this, we talk about feelings a lot. I've learned to say things like, I was feeling tightness in my chest when I thought about this sermon. I was feeling fear about saying these things out loud, particularly to a church I've never been to before. I was feeling worry over how it would be received because no one wants to be the person who brings disillusionment to others. I was noticing I didn't want to say these things. I didn't want to acknowledge the racism that is part of our own history, despite all the reasons I know it must be done. Even a couple of weeks ago, I was considering contacting your music director and saying, let's scrap the whole thing and do something different. I could have come up with something entirely different myself and told myself that would be just fine.
It wouldn't be the first time.
But what I've learned about myself over the years is that when our minds and our bodies are experiencing that kind of fear over something that is truly irrational, I am certain that no one here is going to be hostile to me upon hearing about Ethelred Brown. That is the time to lean into the fear and do it anyway. So in that spirit, I feel the need to tell you about Ethelred Brown. Brown was born in Falmouth, Jamaica, in the British West Indies in 1875. He was the eldest of five children. His younger brothers were supported by their father to go to law school, but he, as the oldest, at a time when his father didn't have the money to send him to school, wasn't able to go. Instead, he applied to the civil service, and he served in the treasury until he was fired at the age of 32. And, like for many people, sometimes when you're fired at a certain age, you realize, maybe there's something else I should be doing. He decided to pursue ministry. However, the struggle became which faith to devote his life to. He grew up Episcopalian, but he struggled with the idea of the Trinity. He just felt like it just didn't make any sense. And then, by happenstance, some could say divine providence, he found that his uncle had a copy of Ellery Channing's sermon that was preached at Jordan Sparks' ordination. This is a very famous sermon by Ellery Channing, where he declared that the Lord our God is one God. It intrigued Brown to learn that in America, there were Christians who didn't believe in the Trinity. Through his uncle, he learned more about Unitarianism and realized he shared the same belief system. This awareness of Unitarianism, however, happened when he was just a choir boy. But he would revisit these beliefs again and again until he committed his life to it in a really fascinating way. I love this particular part of his story where he sent a letter merely, quote, to any Unitarian minister in New York City. Can you even imagine that? He sends a letter to New York City and the address is to any minister in New York City. Amazingly enough, that letter reached the Reverend George Badger, then secretary of the Fellowship Committee of the American Unitarian Association, who referred it to President Franklin Southworth of the Meadville Theological School. I mean, the fact that it happened at all is amazing. How in the world that letter ended up with the president of Meadville is beyond my imagining, but it did. Southworth was very direct with Brown in stating that Meadville did not have a correspondence program, so Brown would have to go to Meadville. In addition, this was clearly at a time when white churches were not taking black ministers and that there would be no black churches. At the same time, Brown had an offer to begin ministry at a local African Methodist Episcopal church where he was assured of long-term employment. This would have been a very easy thing for him to just step into. He was in a quandary beginning between the space of, do I go with the safe, easy route, or do I follow my conscience, knowing that at heart I'm a Unitarian? Clearly, he turned down the offer from the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and he began a long journey to become a Unitarian minister, and then began a ministry in Jamaica and then later in Harlem. From the beginning, the AUA and Brown had very poor communication. This was, of course, a long time before Skype, long before email and even phones. We know so much more about communication now, and we certainly have more technological tools that would have helped Brown and the AUA in their relationship. While on the one hand, Brown received financial support from the AUA in the form of a Brooks Fellowship, he also received discouraging letters from the AUA because there was concern about whether or not he would find a church to pastor upon graduating. However, Brown was not one to be deterred. Despite the many, many obstacles in his way to begin attending Meadville at all, in the interest of time, I will just encourage you to read the book yourself, he did finally graduate. Morrison Reed believes that Brown came into the denomination at a fortuitous time when Samuel A. Eliot had become the president of the AUA. Eliot had a desire for the AUA to take on mission work, and so that's how they perceived what Brown was doing. It wasn't surprising that Brown believed that the AUA would support his ministry in Jamaica because of Eliot being this president of the AUA at the time. So Brown was ordained by the Meadville Unitarian Church in 1912, and in July of that year, he returned to Jamaica to begin his work as a Unitarian missionary. His Jamaican ministry was fraught with financial problems and family challenges. Brown had difficulty building and maintaining a congregation, especially because in the early days, his church mostly consisted of his family and friends. A report from the Reverend Hilary Bygrave, who went to Jamaica to find out the status of the church, indicated that things weren't going well. Bygrave also reported feeling frustrated that Brown had established his church in Montego Bay, Brown's hometown, rather than in Kingston, a larger city where the AUA thought he would have larger success. And in Morrison's book, then he talks about how, like, there's the, how, like, in Jesus talks about you can't be a prophet in your own town. And so here's Brown going back to this place, trying to be recognized, but it wasn't happening. Reverend Bygrave indicated in his report that the AUA thought of Brown's ministry as humanitarian work, not as full ministry. Therefore, he recommended to the AUA that the financial support come to an end. But at the same time, he held out hope that a house of worship would be built. Bygrave's report was just the beginning of the way that the AUA responded to Brown. They seemed intrigued by him, they wanted him to do humanitarian work, and yet they were not very good at stating an unequivocal no. This lack of direct and clear communication led to years of repeated asks from Brown for help with the Jamaican mission. Eventually, it became clear to Brown that a church in Montego Bay was not going to materialize. Instead, he decided to move to Harlem because it was the up-and-coming place for African Americans in the United States. Brown was sure the Unitarian Church would take hold in Harlem. Unfortunately, the financial realities of that time meant that Brown had to work an additional job to support himself, in addition to the church he founded. As Morrison Reed reminds the reader, black churches of all kinds were poor. Therefore, it should not be a surprise that the stewardship from the members of Brown's church wasn't strong enough to support Brown and his family. White ministers and churches could not comprehend this reality. Brown repeatedly asked the AUA and then other Unitarian ministers and their churches for financial support. It would be like another church in another part of the state sending letters here saying, can you support me as a minister? Can you support this church? That's not really done. These financial requests became frustrating to the other ministers who just couldn't understand Brown's situation. It got to the point where the fellowshipping committee repeatedly tried to remove Brown from the roles as a minister, eventually succeeding in their efforts. Brown had to go to the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, for their assistance in getting reinstated as a Unitarian minister. I want to stop here for a second and acknowledge that all of this material is a lot to take in. It can be hard to know what to do with what you're hearing. It may bring up for you a lot of mixed emotions. I encourage you to sit with them and try not to make judgments where possible. But I would also be doing this story a disservice if I didn't tell you about Brown's church and the identity crisis it faced. It went through several names, and it went back and forth, sometimes on a yearly, sometimes every few weeks basis, between being a place that was a forum for political discussion and a place that was about religious worship. His church seemed unsure of what its purpose was and how to maintain it over time. Another stumbling block that he faced was that he was so committed to his own personal ministry, he did not create a plan for succession for his church. When opportunities presented themselves for younger men to take over the church, Brown refused to let go. He could not imagine that the church, this particular church, existing without him, and so, therefore, it didn't. There is no Unitarian or Unitarian Universalist Church in Harlem today. Now that I live close to Harlem, sometimes when I'm going through it, I wonder what could have been. As a former governance geek at my former church, I struggle when reading this story because of the UU emphasis on congregational polity, which means that each church gets to decide how to govern themselves. Each church fully supports themselves and pays for their own ministry. Reading about Brown's repeated requests for financial support from the AUA was challenging for me because of my own ways of understanding congregational polity and, I have to admit, my own internalized racism. White supremacy thinking gets in my head and it doesn't allow for nuance. It says that he should be treated the same as all the other ministers of his time. But the reality is we know his situation wasn't like all the other ministers. He was trying to build a black church in Harlem. It seems to me no other minister was taking on something of this magnitude. While the president of the AUA was getting more and more frustrated with him for being so needy, it appears that no one actually took the time to empathize with his situation. No one mentored him, and no one helped him think strategically about the best way to do this thing no one else had attempted, create a Unitarian church in a black neighborhood. The internal rules I grew up with are the same ones that the leaders of the UA had at the time, I'm sure. When reading Morris and Reed, you can almost hear them saying, "Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, man. You can't be dependent on us forever." At times, I felt sympathy for both sides of this situation, and at times, I was frustrated with both of them, too. In hindsight, it's easy to see that the conflict began from the very, very beginning of Brown's ministry. But the AUA wasn't willing to outright say to Brown that they would not support him. I don't know what's worse, saying an outright no or stringing someone along. It seems to me both are hard. They treated Brown like a child, and they didn't quite know what to do with him, which ended up being a detriment to all concerned. As black pioneers in a white denomination continues, the reader is assured that the AUA seems to have learned some important lessons through its interaction with Brown. It treated Lewis McGee with more respect. There was a lot of thought and analysis put into where a black or interracial church should be planted, and there was support for McGee as he moved forward and created a succession plan of his own. McGee, unlike Brown, saw the work of Unitarianism as bigger than himself. McGee still struggled in his own ways. There were still churches that turned him down, but it was from a place of a better relationship with the AUA, which made a huge difference. Morrison Reed concludes his book with talking about a commission on Unitarian intergroup relations and the deliberative work they did around improving race relations. Unfortunately, this is a repeated story in our movement. Like many commissions before them and since, they made many recommendations, most of which were not implemented. In hindsight, it is easy to look back wistfully and be sad about what could have been had their recommendations been implemented. On the other hand, just having the commission at all was a huge step forward for the AUA's attempt to improve race relations and acknowledging that Unitarianism had a part to play. In thinking about Ethelred Brown, I can't help but think about the messiness of both individuals and institutions. The AUA treated Brown very patronizingly and gave him very little support for his ministerial endeavors. It is very easy to point the finger at all that the AUA did wrong. There is a lot of validity there. At the same time, one can also look at Brown and consider that his absolute devotion, his loyalty to his own mission, beyond even caring for his family, kept him from seeing the bigger mission of the community and passing the baton to younger colleagues. Morrison Reed talks about this quite extensively as he grapples with these same issues. It is so easy to cast blame. As UUs, we are especially positioned to live in the both and of yes, how he was treated was racist and patronizing, and at the same time, there are reasons within Brown himself for for why his church didn't succeed. And it feels really racist and messy and icky to say all of that. I bring this story to you today because I think it's important to acknowledge the complexity of institutions and of individuals. The AUA seemed to not be able to make up its own mind about what kind of relationship they wanted to have with Brown, and therefore they communicated with him very poorly and sent him mixed messages for decades. Friends, ordaining African American men is something we should be proud of. We were one of the early white denominations to do so. But, like so many things in the UU world, it came with a bitter taste. If we truly lived what we said we believed, they would have been treated better and would have received better supports along the way. What we did was a stopgap measure. It is not enough to give verbal support. It must be followed up with actions. As well, it is not enough that we had African American ministers if we didn't actually support them, if we didn't examine our own internalized racism and structures that support racism. Clearly, even in the year 2017, we are still struggling with these issues. Racism is still our constant companion, even in Unitarian Universalism. The majority of today's Unitarian Universalists are like me. We are what is referred to as comer-inners. We came from other religions or no religion. We came into this religious tradition from another tradition where we were personally rejected or we know people who were. We come in these doors with our rose-colored glasses on and we bask in the way people are welcomed and encouraged, and we do a really good job of that. We get involved in the choir. We learn about UUs who have helped make a huge social changes toward improving human rights. We learn so many reasons to be proud of being a Unitarian Universalist. So much so, in fact, that when evidence starts coming our way that perhaps UUs aren't as anti-racist as we claim, we are shocked. It is really hard when we begin to see the chinks in the armor of our own heroes. Reading this book and others, especially in the time period we are living in now, when Unitarian Universalism is at a major crossroads regarding our own structures that uphold white supremacy, was extremely difficult. It really pushed up old stuff for me about both authoritarianism and racism. I have been really struggling with wanting to look at UUism from the bones up, if you will, without all of the structures that we've created. I'd really like to get clear about who and what we say we believe and ask if we are really living our core beliefs. My scared, wondering self wants to get back to these roots. It wants to throw off everything that came off afterwards. But life isn't like that. We don't get to claim parts we like and discard everything else. I cannot be a Unitarian Universalist and not know about our real past. We like to talk about how we went to Selma, but the truth is, we only went after one of our white ministers was killed, not before. We've got to start telling our whole truth. Friends, I am committed to living this faith. However, unlike Rev Silliman, who wrote the reading that we did earlier, I will not give my loyalty commanding. There is a fine line in the middle between questioning and staying loyal, and that is where I intend to stay. As time moves forward, many of us will be wondering where we fit on this continuum. I cannot tell anyone else what to do or what decisions to make. I encourage you to be informed about your faith and to live it to the best of your ability. May we continue to honor each other. May we question, may we encourage, and may we support. Now that the scales have been removed from our eyes, may we see more clearly. Blessed be.